Hi, everybody, and welcome to Home in Progress, brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. I'm Dan Hansen, and on today's episode, we're going to be covering a lot of ground. We're going to end the show with some guidance on choosing the right paint colors for west-facing rooms. You know, that afternoon sun can really change the way a color reads, and we've got the tips to help you get it right. Before that, we're going to be discussing some mysterious white powdery substances that can show up on your basement walls. They look like mold, but they're not. It's called efflorescence, and we're going to break down what causes it and how to deal with it. And coming up next, we're going to talk about something that's often overlooked, but super important, deck safety. You know, collapses, they're rare, but they're not impossible. So we'll walk through a simple annual inspection process that could make all the difference. But right now, I want to start with something that's kind of been on my mind a bit lately. I've been thinking about how quickly technology, and especially AI, is changing, you know, the world of work. And I started thinking about this. I've been thinking about it, but it really hit home maybe a week ago or so when I ran into an article published by Microsoft. Now, Microsoft ran a study with their Bing Copilot AI and ranked the top 40 jobs that are most at risk from AI. AI's coming for these jobs. They listed the top 40 jobs that were at risk, and then they gave the top 40 that are the safest. Now, the at-risk list, it was full of jobs like customer service reps, writers, paralegals, web developers, even some programming roles. Now, the safe list, that was a whole different picture. It was caregivers, cleaners, roofers, pipe fitters, plumbers, plasterers, and right there in the middle of that mix, professional painters. What do all of those safe jobs have in common? I mean, we can see it instantly. They require hands-on work. They require real skill, you know, human judgment. They require a presence. You know, you've got to be on site. A human has to be on site to do these jobs. No matter how smart the tech gets, it can't paint your house. And that really hit me. I love talking about the trades. I love the fact that the value of the trades is becoming more and more apparent to everybody out there. You know, that's great. And I love the fact that that's, you know, coming around, because when I was in high school, and maybe this was true for you, trades were a little bit discouraged. You know, it was all about college. It was all about pursuing some of these big careers. And it's funny because some of these big careers we were encouraged to pursue are the same ones that are in a little bit of jeopardy today, thanks to AI. Now, meanwhile, we've got this, you know, entire world of trade skills that, sure, they can be enhanced by AI. I get that. But they're not going to be replaced by AI. You know, a plumber or an electrician, whoever, might use AI to help diagnose a complex issue. But at the end of the day, somebody still has to do the work. You know, you still need a hands-on skill. You still need people there. And that brings me back to painting, because it's something that I see up close every day. More than all these other trades, I see painting every day, and it's a skill, you know, it's a trade, it's a craft. You know, good painters, they don't just roll color on a wall, they don't just roll paint on the wall. They prep the walls, they patch, they sand, they prime. They know all the things that are necessary to do on a project before they get to applying the paint. And then when they're applying the paint, they understand how humidity is going to affect it. They know which products are going to be best in which situations. They know how to cut razor sharp lines with just a brush, no tape at all. Good painters make all of that look effortless. And I've seen all of this firsthand, not just because I work with it, but because my kid has been working on a painting crew for the past two summers. And when he started, he had no experience. I had not done a lot with him with painting. You know, I normally just took care of that myself. So when he started, no experience. But a few weeks in, he's confidently working on extension ladders, you know, at that point already. I was blown away how fast they had him on the ladders. By the end of that summer, he could pretty much handle anything that they threw at him. And this year, his second year, it's even better. The other night, he was talking about how he could paint our house. You know, I'll just take care of our house if you want me to, Dad. And he means it. And you know what? I might take him up on it. You never know. I mean, you're not going to get that offer very often, so you might as well grab it when you can. Anyway, what really struck me in all of that conversation was something else that he said. And this is really why I wanted to talk about it in the first place. He was talking about how satisfying it is to finish a job and actually see, you know, the transformation, the before and the after, the faded siding that looked bad, and now it looks good again. And that's different. That's really different to me from the kind of satisfaction that I get at work. And I love what I do. Don't get me wrong. I make things. I solve problems. Sometimes I make problems and then I solve them. But some days, a lot of days, all I feel like technically I've done is move digital ideas from one folder to another. You know, it's progress, but not quite the same as standing back and seeing a house completely transformed because you made it happen. You know, he comes home with pictures, he points out tricky spots, the colors that he liked, and he's proud of himself. And it made me realize once again that there's something incredibly rewarding about the trades. It's physical, it's creative, it's demanding, but it's real work. It's literal stuff you're doing. You know, I work with painting contractors every day, and I just want to say this. These folks are professionals. You know, they're running businesses, they're managing crews, they're coordinating with builders, with homeowners. They're making a space beautiful, you know, whether it's a brand new office building or kitchen cabinet repaint in somebody's home or what, a library, a bedroom. I don't have to list rooms. You know what I'm saying? The painters, they're showing up, they're communicating, they're delivering quality work, and that work matters. And no matter how fast technology moves and improves, that isn't going away. You know, the trades are always going to require real people. In fact, I think the human touch is probably only going to become more and more valuable in a world that becomes increasingly digital. You know, AI is not going to walk into somebody's home with a drop cloth. It's not going to stand there with a homeowner second-guessing their color and help them feel confident in their choice. It's not going to climb a ladder or roll a ceiling or touch up a baseboard. That still takes people. So if you're a painting contractor out there, keep doing what you're doing. It matters. And if you're somebody looking for a career path, something you can learn, something you can build on, something real, you know, maybe painting or any of the trades, but let's focus on painting, you know, in this last little bit. Painting might just be worth a closer look. So check that out. And even if painting isn't a career path for you, remember at RepcoLite, we're here to help you with whatever you're working on at home so that you can experience that same sense of satisfaction at a job well done that I was talking about earlier. You know, it doesn't matter your skill level. Stop out at the closest RepcoLite and we'll help you get moving. All right, let's talk deck safety. They don't fail often, but when they do, it's catastrophic. So coming up next, I'll walk you through a quick inspection that you can do today to make sure your deck is safe for the rest of the season. That's all coming up right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Top tier paint, expert advice. Your next project is way easier than you think it's going to be. All right, we're here. Let's talk about deck collapses. You know, decks falling down. Now, thankfully, this is a rare occurrence, but it can happen. And when it does happen, the deck collapse usually results in serious injuries or worse. Now, the good news, of course, is that a quick safety check is super easy to do, and it can give you real peace of mind and make sure that your family, your friends, everybody is safe throughout the rest of deck season. So let's talk about it. And right off the bat, I want to talk about the risk, you know, the risk of your deck collapsing. What is the real risk of that? To be honest, the injuries from this kind of thing, they don't show up in the headlines every day because it's incredibly rare. You know, like I said already, they're thankfully rare. It's really rare. Most likely, you're not going to encounter this. And that made me hesitant to even talk about it in the first place. Why waste time talking about something that most of us probably won't encounter? The reason I chose to do that is because when the accidents happen, and they do happen from time to time, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, if I'm reading that right, they estimate that there are around 6,000 injuries every year tied to failures with decks, you know, and then they add in porches, stairs, balconies, things like that. But a large part of it is from deck failure, and about 6,000 injuries every year. And because decks are elevated, usually they're up in the air somewhere, when a collapse does occur, they're almost guaranteed to cause injuries. It's usually just a matter of how bad those injuries are going to be. So maybe you remember this particular case. I did not, but maybe you do. One of the most well-known deck collapses happened back in 2003 in Chicago. A large group of young adults, they were on a third-story wooden deck when it gave way. The weight of the collapse carried two lower decks down with it. So three total decks collapse in that event in Chicago back in 2003. And in the end, you know, the aftermath of all of that, 13 people had died and 57 others were injured. So while deck failures and collapses and all of that are rare, they're not small events when they happen. All right. So that's why we're talking about it. And like I said, because you can check your deck right now today after the show and make sure you're fine. You know, that's why we're talking about it. Now, let's get to what usually causes a deck to collapse. And the most common failure point by far is the ledger board. Now, in case you're not sure what that is or where that is, it's the board that connects your deck directly to the house. Usually it's made from pressure-treated lumber, but that doesn't make it immune to problems. And the biggest culprit with this ledger board is usually moisture. Now, if the flashing on your house, you know, the metal or vinyl barrier that keeps water out, if that flashing wasn't installed correctly or has failed over time, water can sneak behind the ledger board and then start to rot the wood that it's fastened to. You know, that's usually the rim joist inside the wall of your home. And once that rim joist starts to soften or decay, it can't hold the bolts that are anchoring the ledger board in place, and they'll just pull free, and that takes the ledger board right with it, even if it looked solid, even if the ledger board looked fine. Now, in some older decks, especially those built before code updates in the early 2000s, or maybe DIY projects that, you know, we skipped a few steps on, in those cases, the ledger board might not even be pressure treated, so that's possible, or it might be cut or drilled improperly and never sealed up. So moisture was able to creep in and slowly break it down. That's less common, but it happens. Another big issue is how the ledger was attached. Using plain nails instead of bolts or leg screws creates a much weaker connection. You know, after that 2003 Chicago collapse that I was talking about earlier, building codes were updated to require stronger ledger attachments like bolts or leg screws instead of nails. Now, the big problem is that over time, of course, nails can loosen. And if they aren't corrosion resistant, they could even rust completely. And that can leave your deck looking solid, you know, seeming like everything's great, but hiding serious weaknesses. So those are some of the big concerns with the ledger board. But that's not the only concern. Railings, they're another frequent failure point. If they're not securely fastened or if they're not bolted into proper framing, they can give way when somebody leans on them. You know, that's exactly when they tend to fail, when somebody's leaning back, resting their full weight against the railing, thinking it's safe. It's also worth looking underneath the deck, you know, at the posts and the joists that support everything. Most of these are going to be pressure treated, but exposure to sun, moisture, insects, all of that can cause rot, warping, splitting, whatever. And if your deck posts are sunk directly into the soil instead of sitting on concrete footings, they may be rotting from below without you even knowing it. Finally, last thing, many decks develop problems with their metal connectors, things like joist hangers, bolts, screws, things like that. These components, they carry a huge portion of the structural load, and if they're rusted out or missing, or, you know, maybe they weren't installed right in the first place, if that's the case, any of those things are the case, the deck's safety is compromised. So when you take all of that, ledger board issues, loose railings, rotted support posts, rusted hardware, take all of that into account, it's easy to see how a deck that looks perfectly fine on the surface could be hiding some big problems underneath, right? That part makes sense. Now let's make it all practical and take the fear out of it so that you can rest in peace. I don't mean that. I don't want you to rest in peace, literally. I want you to rest peacefully because you're not concerned anymore, because you've taken care of your deck, because you've looked for things and you've eliminated any scary possibilities. How word choice can change a conversation so dramatically. I want you to rest peacefully knowing that your deck is safe. And if you want to dig deeper into the soundness of your deck, that's what we're after, right? We want our family and friends, when we're entertaining in the fall months, in great Michigan fall weather, we want to make sure that we're safe. Here's a quick safety check that you can do today, right after the show. In fact, after I told you to rest in peace, maybe you want to just turn the show off and head out there right now, you know, as soon as I give you the info. Either way, go outside, you know, because that's where most of your decks are going to be located, and then start by walking the entire surface of the deck slowly. You know, pay attention to how it feels. Do the boards bounce underneath your feet? Are, you know, they springy, anything like that? Are any of them warped? Are any of them uneven? All of that's worth noting. Then check the railing. Give it a firm push. You don't lean on it with all your weight. That's not how you test it. It is how you test it. You'll find a weakness that way, but you don't want to be on the ground as you're pondering and calculating just exactly how weak it was. You want to be standing on the deck. So push on it a little bit, put some weight on it, lean on it, make sure it's sturdy. Make sure that somebody at your party or at your next event, if they lean on it, it's not going to have a problem. If it wobbles, if it creaks, if it does anything like that, that's something to dig into a little bit deeper. And of course, fix it sooner rather than later. All right, if you're able to get safely underneath your deck, take a look at the area where the deck connects to the house. You know, this is probably the biggest area to make sure that you're examining and to make sure that it's safe. Go and look where the deck connects to the house. Find that big board that runs that full length. That's the ledger board that we talked about. Is the flashing intact? Look for that. Do you see any signs of rot or water damage along the house or the ledger itself? Anything like that. And while you're down there, look at how that ledger board is attached. If you see only nails, you know, no bolts, no leg screws, it's time to think about reinforcing that connection. Now, if you've got a screwdriver or a small awl, AWL, a small awl, use it to gently press into any suspicious looking wood. You know, the joist, the post, the ledger, whatever looks suspect. You know, if the tip sinks easily in, you know, a quarter inch or more, that could indicate rot or decay and you're going to want to investigate further. Also, while you're down there, check for any rusted or missing screws, check for nails or hangers that aren't in great condition. If anything looks corroded, tighten it up or swap it out with a corrosion-resistant replacement. As for the posts, make sure they're resting on proper concrete footings and not buried in the ground. Posts in direct soil, they do tend to, you know, rot a little bit faster. So look into that. Look for signs of movement, shifting, cracks at the base. Anything that looks a little bit suspect. You know, these are the kinds of things that sneak up on people. They're often what cause the most damage. So all of that, it shouldn't take you more than, you know, 10, 15 minutes to go around, make sure everything's good. Chances are you're going to walk away feeling that everything checked every box. It all looks good. But it's worth doing because if you do find anything, you're going to be so glad that you did. Now, normally this is a basic safety inspection that you would do once a year. Ideally in the spring before your deck sees a lot of heavy use. But for sure, right now, if you haven't done it yet, get out there and do it today. It's not going to take long. Could save you a lot of trouble down the road. Now, if your deck is over 15 to 20 years old, or if maybe you notice something when you go around and do the check, you know, something that seems questionable, it might be a smart move to bring in a licensed contractor. You know, it doesn't have to be a big ordeal, but having a pro check things out, especially with older decks, or ones that are built before 2003, that can give you a lot of peace of mind. We mentioned it earlier, but building codes changed significantly in the early 2000s, and a lot of older decks just weren't built to the standards that we see today. So remember, deck collapses are really rare. I'm not trying to hype everybody up, get everybody freaked out. They're really rare, but that little safety check that we walked through, that could save you a lot of trouble down the road. It's worth doing just to make sure everything's good. And if you do go through that inspection and you decide that the only thing wrong with your deck is that the wood hasn't been protected in a while, then swing out to your closest Repcolite and we'll walk you through the process so you can clean the wood and get a wood protector on there that's going to dramatically enhance the look of the wood, but which also is going to protect it from sun, rain, weather, all of that. You know, regularly coating and protecting the wood of your deck is just one more way that you can make sure that you keep that surface in good shape for as long as possible. It's not a bad project. And this time of year, it's definitely something you can jump into and tackle. Stop out at any Repcolite. We'll walk you through it. All right. Have you ever uncovered or discovered, I guess I should say, a white powdery substance? Maybe it's just little streaks. Maybe it's just a hint of it. Maybe it's full-on fuzzy stuff seeming to grow out of the block walls in your basement. Have you ever run into that? If you have, I'm sure it startled you because it's definitely not something you want to see down there. We're going to talk about exactly what it is, what's going on, how to fix it, and how to make sure it doesn't come back. And we'll get to all of that right after this. This is Home in Progress, where the to-do list is long, and that's all right. We're not crabbing at you. We're not going to yell at you. That's how it is. It's how ours is, too. It's proudly supported by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore, because home projects are easier when you've got people you can trust. All right, for this next segment, just imagine for a second this scenario. You go down to your basement and you notice something odd on the walls. You know, the block wall, the concrete wall that you've got down there has developed these strange white, you know, chalky streaks. Maybe it's literal fuzzy stuff that seems to be growing out of the wall, white fuzzies growing out of the wall. It wasn't there before. It wipes off pretty easily with your hand, but then you notice a few weeks later they come back pretty readily. You know, what in the world is going on? Well, it's not mold. It's not a bad paint job. It's something else entirely. It's called efflorescence, and it's actually pretty common. What is efflorescence? Let's dig into that right off the bat. It's basically just salt deposits that are forming on masonry surfaces like brick, concrete block, poured concrete, you know, things like that. And it happens when water moves through a wall, one way or the other. It's moving through a wall. It's picking up salts from the masonry material as it travels through. And then when the water reaches the surface and evaporates, it leaves those salts behind, leaving you with that white residue. Now, sometimes it's subtle, you know, just a light dusting of it. Other times, you know, it looks like full-on streaks or even this fuzzy or crusty buildup. You know, it looks pretty gross sometimes. That's efflorescence. And if you think about it, you know, what I just described, if you think about that for a second, you realize that the trigger for efflorescence is moisture. So if you've got efflorescence on a wall, it's a sure sign that there's some kind of moisture issue at play in your space. You know, that moisture could be coming from outside. It could be poor drainage, clogged gutters, improper grading around your home, something like that. It could be coming from inside, like a damp basement or even, you know, vapor movement from interior spaces. But wherever it's coming from, there's a moisture issue. So how do you fix this? Well, the first step to fixing efflorescence is to clean it. And that's really not that hard. You can remove efflorescence with a stiff brush and plain water. If you've got really stubborn buildup, you might need to get a diluted solution of white vinegar or even a masonry cleaner that's designed specifically for efflorescence. If you do that, just be sure to follow the manufacturer's instructions, wear protective gear, you know, all the things, do all the safety things, do it right, because some of those cleaners are a little bit acidic. But here's the thing. Cleaning is really only solving the symptom. The white powder might go away for now, but unless you address that issue, that moisture issue that's causing it, it's going to come back. And that means you're going to need to inspect the area for leaks. You're going to need to check your downspouts, your grading. You might need to seal cracks in the foundation walls. I don't know. You'll have to just take a look and try to figure out where the moisture is coming from. Now, for me, I ran into this in my basement years back, and it freaked me out. I thought it was something really gross growing on the walls. When I figured out what it was, I felt a little bit better, but then I had to address the moisture problem. And my situation, it was really easy to diagnose. The house had no gutters installed on it. So all the water would pour off the roof, you know, rainwater, straight at the foundation, and that's where it was coming from. So I had to install gutters around the home, and that completely took care of the moisture problem, and the efflorescence went away. So you'll have to figure out your situation. The efflorescence is just a sign that there's too much moisture going through those walls. You'll just need to figure out what's causing that. All right, so what do? Can you paint over it? You know, how do you get the walls looking good again? Well, you can't paint over it until the wall is completely dry, you know, if moisture's moving through it. And you've got to deal with that source of moisture. You know, that's got to be fixed, really, before you can paint over this issue with any kind of lasting success. You know, if you paint over active efflorescence, you're basically just sealing in the problem a little bit. You're covering it over with a Band-Aid, let's say. That's a smarter way to say it. The moisture and the salt, they're still going to continue to work their way to the surface, except now they're going to bring the paint with them. You know, they're going to cause blistering, peeling, things like that. More frustration. I've lived this. The first time I dealt with mine, I just painted over it thinking that might do it, and it did not do it. I had to repaint again, and now I had peeling paint and all of those things to deal with. Now, if you figured out your moisture problem and took care of it and you need to repaint, you just need to get that powdery residue gone. And we talked about how to clean that off, get that off, and then you can repaint. If you've got bare concrete walls or block, something that's never, ever been painted, you could consider using a special water blocking product like Water Block from Insulex. Stop out at any Repcolite and ask about it. There are specific application instructions and conditions that need to be followed for the product to work. But Water Block will prevent a certain level of moisture from, you know, traveling through the walls, but it has to be applied over concrete that's never been painted. Be aware it's out there. That's why I bring it up. Water Block from Insulex. All right, efflorescence. It's one of those issues that looks like a cosmetic problem, but really it is a bit of a red flag. You know, it's not dangerous or gross or anything like that, but it is a sign that moisture is moving where it shouldn't be. If you have any questions, stop out at your closest Repcolite and let us help. All right. Choosing colors for west-facing rooms. It can be a bit of an adventure, and I'm going to walk you through everything you need to know right after this. You're listening to Home in Progress, where the projects are real, the mistakes, they're educational, sometimes painful, mostly educational, and the only thing more stubborn than that old wallpaper on your bathroom wall is your determination to get it fixed. Proudly sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Paint with a purpose, people who care, and everything you need to get the job done right. Well, over the last few weeks, we've been working our way through, you know, one of the most important and most overlooked aspects of interior painting, of choosing the colors when you're doing interior painting, and that's the direction that your room faces. You know, my mom has painted rooms in our home as far back as I can remember. I mean, lots and lots of rooms. She did it often. It wasn't really that unusual to arrive home from school. And honestly, to walk into the space, it sounds ridiculous. Nah, it is ridiculous. We'd walk into the breezeway, and there was a part of you that kind of wondered for a split second if you were in the right house. Because you didn't even know that the room was going to be a different color when you left in the morning. I mean, it wasn't on anybody's radar. We were all surprised. And that would happen throughout the home all the time. All the time. I've told you about that. But with all of that painting that mom did, all the time that she spent choosing colors, I really can't remember one single time when she was talking about the room exposure for whatever room she was painting. You know, on the radio here, in the store at Repcolite, when I worked there, I've talked a lot about color, and I've helped a lot of people find colors for their home. And I've asked a lot of questions when people come in. You know, I do my due diligence. What's on the floor? Is it carpet? Is it hardwood? What's the color of that material? Do you have a sample of it? That'd be great. I've asked about how much natural lighting is in the space, about furniture colors, about artwork. I've asked all kinds of important questions that are necessary when you're picking colors. But I can't remember ever once asking what direction the room faced. So I'm making up for that the best I can by diving into the different exposures and what each one does to the colors in your space. Now, we've already talked about north-facing rooms and the challenges of their cooler, flatter light. We've explored south-facing rooms where the light is bright and consistent. A couple weeks ago, we dug into east-facing spaces and their shifting tones from morning to afternoon. Today, we're going to wrap up this little series by turning our attention to west-facing rooms. And let me tell you, if you've ever felt like your paint color changes throughout the day, like dramatically changes, or worse, starts to look really strange and unpredictable by late afternoon, this might be the episode that answers some of the questions you've got. All right, here's what makes west-facing rooms such a challenge. In the morning, they're cool, they're shady, they're a little bit flat. Not shady like, well, you know what I'm saying. I don't need to make a joke about that. Shady sounds like, you know, the guy on the street corner in the alley. You know, he's a little shady. He's leaning against the wall. He's got his hat pulled down over his eyes. You don't even remotely think that's what I was referring to, so I can just leave that ridiculousness and not even talk about it. So I'm not even going to mention that. So in the morning, these rooms are cool. They're shady. They're a little bit flat. The sun is rising on the opposite side of the house. So these spaces feel a little bit sleepy, right? But then as the afternoon rolls in, things start to change. And by mid-afternoon, especially early evening, western light is pouring into those spaces. And it brings with it a strong reddish golden warmth that often has rich amber or peach undertones. Now, it's beautiful, beautiful light, but it is kind of unpredictable. That subtle beige that you loved at noon, for example. You know, imagine a beige, you love it at noon. It might look orangish by 5 o'clock. That soft gray, that can suddenly look a little bit pink as the afternoon deepens. The calm, muted space that you enjoyed at breakfast time might actually feel overly warm and energized by dinner. So in short, it's a lighting personality shift that makes color selection a little bit tough. And getting it right comes down to a couple things. And these things are pretty much the case in any exposure, but you know, we're still going to talk about them here. You've got to think about when you use the space the most. That's important. And what kind of feeling you want to create in that space. Those are the two things that will really help you get to where you need to be color-wise. All right. So let's start with the time of day that you most often are in this room using it. And because the light changes so dramatically in a west-facing space, you can't always find one perfect color that works at every single hour, right? We talked about the same idea with east-facing spaces. There is no one-size-fits-all color. So instead of trying to find magic, we really need to just focus on the time that matters most to you and choose a color that works well there and just live with it through the rest of the time. You know, as long as it's not too off-putting in the other parts of the day, it's still a win if you love it in the time of day that you're most often in that space. All right. So if you use the room mostly in the morning, that's when the west-facing spaces are at their flattest and their coolest, right? We talked about them being a little sleepy, them being a little shady, like that guy on the street corner, you know, the alley guy, the hat pulled low, a little bit shady. So are these rooms in the morning. Now, if you want to counteract that, you might want to bring in some warmth with your color. Now, it doesn't mean you need to go full Tuscan sunset on your walls. In fact, too much warmth in a space like this, on a western-facing space, can make that afternoon light feel completely overwhelming. But a gentle warm beige, a soft taupe, you know, even a richer, you know, warm grayish color, that can bring just enough tone, just enough color to the morning light without turning the space, you know, into the face of the sun when afternoon comes around. Now, if you're not into warm tones, you can still use cooler colors. Just make sure they're not too gray. You know, a cool blue, a green, maybe a violet color. They can all liven up a space that otherwise feels dim and sleepy in the morning. Lighting is going to be really important here in the morning hours, especially. A 2700K or a 3000K light bulb can help simulate a soft, natural warmth and make even a shaded space, a shady space, feel inviting before the sun shows up. Remember, we talked about it a couple weeks ago. The daylight bulbs sound really good. You know, that sounds like what you want, but generally the light they give off is too white or too stark. So the soft white bulbs in that 2700K to 3000K range are going to add warmth into the space during the morning hours when it's not naturally present, All right, so keep that in mind. Keep the lighting in mind. Now, if you use the room mostly in the afternoon, this is when Western light is at its boldest. You know, it's warm, it's direct, it's full of amber and orange tones. In this case, if this is when you're in the space, the name of the game for you is balance, you know, finding balance here. Cooler tones generally are going to be your friends, especially blues, greens, purples, if you would lean into that. You know, not everybody loves purple, but that would work here. Neutrals with those undertones would work. You know, they're going to help calm down the intensity of that late day glow without making the room feel cold. That said, if you love warmer colors, if that's your gig, if that's your jam, you don't have to avoid them altogether. You just need to choose ones with, you know, a bit more of a neutral base or a gray base. Colors that are grounded. You know, you don't want anything that's too golden. Think maybe soft putties, earthy blushes, things with muted depth. A few weeks ago, I talked about a yellow that we had used, and I brought that yellow. It was used in a west-facing room. I brought it into my east-facing room, and it didn't look good at all. It looked really green and stuff on the walls. I hated it in that room. And I was blown away that that was the same color, you know, between the two rooms. In that west-facing room, that yellow is absolutely wonderful. And we completely did it without thinking about the exposure. We picked the color without thinking about that. But the yellow that we picked has cooler undertones. So as the warmer western light is coming through in the afternoons, it just warms that yellow up to exactly what we would want it to feel like. It doesn't get overpowering because it's got those cooler or grounded tones, you know, those undertones that keep it a little more balanced. So make sure you're keeping that in mind. You don't have to completely avoid warmer colors. Just make sure you're careful when you choose them. Now, when it comes to specific colors, Benjamin Moore has a ton of great options for pretty much every situation that we talked about. And I'm going to reel off a fair amount of colors here, maybe 8 to 9 or so. Don't worry so much about memorizing them. There will not be a test afterwards. If you do have notepads, you can write them down. Otherwise, just head to repcolite.com and check out the blog post about west-facing spaces. And I've got all the colors right there. All right. So if you're leaning cool and you want to calm down, you know, the afternoon warmth, you want that cool feeling in the afternoon, moonshine. You don't need the liquor. That probably, I don't know, that could help. That could mess things up. That's not what I'm recommending. The color is moonshine. It's a barely there gray with a quiet coolness. I mean, it sounds perfect. So that would be one option. Silver Chain, another Benjamin Moore color. It's going to add a little more richness without feeling too heavy. White Heron, White Wisp, they're both soft whites with cool undertones that won't yellow up too much in golden light. Now, if you do want a touch of warmth for the early morning hours, Edgecombe Gray, that's a favorite. It's warm, but not too golden. Pale Oak has a subtle kind of creamy look to it that's great for shaded spaces. Pale Oak, that would work really well. Hazy Skies kind of walks the line, like Johnny Cash walks the line. Hazy Skies walks the line between warm and cool with a bit of a soft, earthy base. If you want a bold and dramatic space, especially one that you use in the evening, Silvery Blue, Catalina Blue, both are going to feel fresh and clean as the sun comes pouring in. Casbah, like rock the Casbah, it's a rich earthy blue that grounds a room and absorbs light beautifully. And if you want a no-fail trim or ceiling color that works well with all of the above, normally we would say all of the above. Sometimes I like to shorten it just to speed things along, and I just say all of the above. You know, I drop letters left and right. If you want a color that works well with all of the above, try Chantilly Lace. It's clean, bright, perfectly neutral. You'll love it. You'll thank me later. So I'm going to put all of those in show notes, and you can also go find them at repcolite.com. Just check out our blog post for west-facing spaces. And while you're there, check out the blog posts on the other exposures. Lots of great info all right there. All right, at the end of the day, west-facing rooms, they're a little bit unpredictable, right? I think we gathered that as we walked through this, but they're also full of personality. You know, they can be vibrant, glowing, moody, calm, all of these different things. You just have to learn to work with the light, not against it. So take your time. Test your samples at different times of day. So critical. Benjamin Moore has color samples available. Half pint of paint. It's about $5-6, something like that. It is just such an easy way to literally get some paint in your hands without dropping a lot of money. Sample it on your wall, sample it on some poster board or foam board that you can move around the space and look at it at different times of the day. And when you're doing that, don't worry that the color's got to be perfect all the time. You know, we talked about that. It's going to be tough to find a color that's perfect all the time. So choose a color that looks best when you're mostly using that room. That's what you're shooting for. And just make sure it doesn't look like garbage the rest of the day. If it looks like garbage the rest of the day, keep looking. If it looks okay, you know, you can live with it the rest of the day, you might have found the color that you want for that space. And of course, if you're unsure, come see us at RepcoLite. We've got all the samples, the swatches, the expertise to help you find the color that works with your light, your life, your style, everything you could possibly want. So stop out at a store and let us help. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home in Progress. Thanks so much for spending time with us today. We hope you're walking away with a few new ideas, maybe even a little inspiration, you know, for your next project. If you liked what you heard, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And if you have a second, leave us a rating or a quick review. It really helps more people find the show. Home in Progress is brought to you by RepcoLite Paints and Benjamin Moore, offering expert advice, premium products, and everything you need to keep your home moving forward. I'm Dan Hansen. I'll see you next time.